The show's called Kaleidoscope. So we pick a topic and we explore every single inch of it. And today we are focusing on weird hobbies. So who do I get into co-host on Weird Hobby Day? Faraz Javi. Good morning, Faraz.
Hello, Ray. How are you?
How you doing? You all right?
I'm good.
Good to have you with me this morning.
It's always a pleasure.
Now, I'm a bit worried because this morning you have got a plastic folder, containing something that you used to spend your time doing.
Yes.
And I've got no idea what you're going to tell us a little bit later on what it is.
I am, but I'm going to share this little story with you if I'm allowed to right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I was yesterday filming a corporate video somewhere in DIFC. It was
okay.
A new restaurant that was opening up. And long story short, is while I was filming, what I noticed was when the chef made this dish, there were a lot of people taking pictures of that dish. Now,
uh-huh.
That's the kind of environment that I would personally see when celebrities are present.
Yes.
But this was completely unique. So I asked them, like, guys, what's going on? And this is our hobby. This is what we're passionate about. And what struck me is it's not always about celebrities. It's about what you truly, truly fancy. And
yes.
if you really are passionate about something, that thing or that moment is like a celebrity for you.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And today's program, the next couple of hours, is going to absolutely prove that theory of yours, because you're going to hear from people who are extremely passionate about things that you and I quite possibly would just say, I don't get it. I do not get it. We're going to speak to somebody who is obsessed with roundabouts and travels the world photographing roundabouts. Somebody who is a baggiophile. What on earth is a baggiophile? Stay tuned to find out. It's bizarre, I promise you that. We're going to hear from somebody who has spent every single day of the last 40-odd years painting a baseball, a different coat, every single day.
Get
and it's become,
here.
And it's and like you say, it's become a local celebrity. He's become a local celebrity, but the ball itself has become a local celebrity. It's like, if you imagine a baseball, it's now like the size of a truck, this thing, because it's been painted every single day. And so people can get extremely passionate about very strange things, but if it's your hobby and you enjoy it, it doesn't hurt anybody, who are we to say it's a bad thing?
Absolutely.
But we want to hear from our listeners today, from you guys, what is your hobby? It doesn't have to be weird. It could be, you know, a sort of a general hobby, but if, you know, the weirder the better, basically we would say, wouldn't we?
And I would say dig deep. You know, find, because it might also be something that you don't do anymore.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely, yeah. Maybe there's like a weird sort of obsession that you had in the past, something you just got into because, you know, the group that you were with, you've got all of those things still in the house. You haven't got rid of them yet.
Yeah.
Because some people are collectors.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do things. You know, you can have a collecting hobby, a doing hobby. You know, there's so many different ways to pass the time and things that become hobbies. Right. When we come back on this show, we will be chatting to a psychologist about the psychology of weird hobbies and why people get obsessed with some of these strange pastimes. Stay with us. We're looking at the subject of weird hobbies. Lots of texts. We'll get to those in a moment as well. Lots of calls as well. But we need to set the context of this. We need to know what counts as weird and why people like them. So joining us on the line now is Dr. Justin Thomas. He's the Associate Professor of Psychology from Zayed University in Abu Dhabi. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good, thank you.
Excellent. Great to have you join us on the programme. Now, weird hobbies. Why do people become obsessed with things that you could class as kind of bizarre, weird subjects?
Okay, well, I mean, psychologists have got lots of different perspectives on this, and I think for me, the one that, I must say, not the one that I agree with perhaps the most, but it's the one that intrigues me the most, is known as the psychoanalytic perspective.
Mm.
And this is kind of going back to the ideas of Sigmund Freud, and we sometimes call this deep psychology. And the idea here is that the actual hobby itself, if you like, is symbolic. It represents, if you like, either some hidden aspect or some hidden part, or perhaps even an acceptable outlet for an unacceptable urge. Mm. And the hobby, if you like, you can kind of work backwards from the hobby to try and understand something deeper about the individual. So that's one perspective as to why some people's hobbies might seem rather strange or unusual. Mm. But there are a few different perspectives on this. But I actually like the psychoanalytic perspective because you kind of see a continuum, if you like, between some hobbies and certain psychological disorders. So you can kind of, you know, not to say that hobbies are psychological disorders, but you can kind of see a connection or a link, if you like, between somebody who is an obsessive stamp collector who yes. has, you know, hundreds of, you know, alphabetized manuals and things like this, and something like, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder. So you can kind of trace that line, if you like, in terms of, you know, from an extreme to, you know, something that's acceptable and maybe just seems to other people a bit bizarre.
But is it always some sort of a disorder, doctor, or is it some sort of a driving passion that makes this person keep going or, you know, doing this year after year and never get tired of it?
Yeah, I think that's another great question. I have to separate that into two pieces, really. One is initiation and the other is maintenance. So there might be lots of different reasons why we start. You know, it could be, you know, friends or, you know, parents even encourage us to get involved in something. But that passion you talk about, that's what that's the maintenance element that keeps us doing this thing for years and years, long after maybe other people tried it, you know, kind of grew out of it, and we continue it. It connects to something deeper in us. It fulfills and perhaps some need. And no, I think you're exactly right. We're not trying to pathologize the hobby. The hobby is healthy, but you can see it's arguably, it connects to our personality and perhaps the way in which some psychological disorders connect to our personality. Although the hobby is, if you like, an acceptable and a healthy response, perhaps, to either some early life experience or some deficit within ourselves or something that we would really like to do but can't do, and we substitute it with if you like the acceptable form, which is the hobby. So yeah, hobbies are definitely not ordinarily they're not classed as psychological disorders at all. In fact, many psychologists encourage people to take up hobbies as a means to overcome certain psychological problems.
If somebody's listening to this right now, Doc, and their partner is obsessed or seems to be obsessed with, you know, like you said, you gave the example there of collecting stamps. Should they potentially treat it as a warning sign that there could be another issue going on there?
I don't think so at all. I think hobbies can become problematic. So you draw a line. Where do we draw the line between obsessive, you know, problematic behavior and the hobby? And I think that's really difficult to do with any sort of, you know, hard and fast rule. Mm. But as a general rule of thumb, if we have this idea of 3 D's, so does it cause distress? Does it cause distress for the person who has the pastime? Does it cause distress for other people? If no, you know, let's carry on. There's no problem there. Second D, deviation. Does it deviate from what's normal? Okay, and this one's, again, where do we draw the line for normal? So, but is it deviant? Do lots of people do it? Do only a few people do it? Do you do it for 18 hours a day, or do you do it for 2 hours a day? So again, just about quantification of how far away from normality it is. Mm. And then the third one, which is the most important one, is dysfunction. Does the hobby or does the activity, whatever it is, lead to dysfunction? Is the person still able to hold down a job? Do they still take care of their, you know, familial, marital responsibilities? If yes, then there's no problem there at all. Mm. And as I say, often the hobby is something that is helping the person become whole. You know, it's helping them feel good. It's making them healthy. So, yeah, I mean, often what you might happen, if you stop somebody from doing their hobby, then you might see some problems.
Mm. Doc, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Much appreciated. And please do come back and join us in future on the programme.
Will do. My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Justin Thomas there, Associate Professor of Psychology at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi. Tell us what your weird hobby is. And we're getting some crackers through, I tell you. Omar joins us on the line. Good morning, Omar.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Hey, yeah, we're good, thanks. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Now, what's your hobby, Omar? What do you do?
My hobby is football.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's not really that weird to a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
but I like to collect football jerseys from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, I love taking pictures of footballing celebrities.
How many years have you been doing this, Omar?
Since I was a kid. I don't know, maybe like 20 years.
And what first attracted you to doing that, to collecting the jersey, to get the pictures taken?
Well, I used to, with the jerseys, I used to just like buy jerseys like to wear, and then I never like when they get like too small for me, I never wanted to throw them out. I just keep them,
mm-hmm.
and just put them away. And then like a few years back, I started like pulling stuff, old stuff out of my closet, and I like discovered I had like jerseys from the like 80s and 90s.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, so I should just keep that and just keep adding to my collection, and just went on from there. And with celebrities, just football celebrities, not any other celebrity, but just like I could see like a Hollywood celebrity, and I wouldn't even care, but it's just the football part that I'm really crazy about.
Yeah.
So like,
how far have you gone to get a picture? Like, what was the hardest picture to get?
Maybe 15 years ago, when I was a kid, I was with my friends. We were still like middle school, and we basically like stalked the AS Roma team when they were in Egypt, in Cairo, just to get pictures like with them. Like they were like cool with getting like their pictures taken, but the security was too tight at the time. And so we went to the hotel, and one of my friends had like a hookup with like they knew the manager there, and they let us in, but security of the team wouldn't let us take pictures and stuff.
Mm.
So we found out their itinerary and like basically followed them to the pyramids, got some pictures there, and then we couldn't get the rest of the players, so we ended up following them to the Egyptian Museum, bought tickets, walked in, and like security just went crazy at that point. They're like, you know what, we're just going to give up right here. You guys are just much here. Take your pictures and just go.
That's definitely passionate.
I wouldn't go that far right now. Like, I grew a little bit out of it, but like,
nor will we recommend people to go that far.
Yeah.
So, Omar, you've been collecting since football jerseys from a very young age. Did you ever feel it was like peer pressure at some point that you kind of like had to do it to be part of the group?
No, it's just me, actually. It's just me. It's actually on the contrary. My wife is like, she'd come by and she's like, you need this, why don't we throw this out? I'm like, no, don't touch that. I have a bag full of jerseys. I'm like, don't touch that. You can, we can throw anything out, but my jerseys and like stuff like that, my memorabilia, no way.
How long have you been married for, Omar?
3 years.
Yeah, after about year five, things start disappearing.
Is that experience?
Yes. Your favorite jumper, I'm telling you, Omar, seriously, you need to lock them up because she will gradually chuck them out. She will gradually.
No, we just did a summer cleanup because I had a lot of like stuff that I had to throw out, and I was like, we'll throw out everything except that stuff.
Yeah. Is there like one last question for you, because we've got to go to the news headlines, but is there just one part of your collection, whether it's a particular photograph or a particular jersey, that you would just hate to lose, you know, if that the one thing you would kind of save in a fire or something?
Definitely my oldest jersey. It's I have a Canada 1986 jersey from the World Cup, and you know Canada doesn't make the World Cup that often, so it's a huge deal. Actually, I didn't even buy it because I'm born 85, so just a friend of mine like had a collection, he gave it to me, passed it on to me, so that's basically my oldest jersey. Photographs like with like legends like Ruud Gullit, Zinedine Zidane, Roberto Carlos.
Omar, thank you very much for joining us this morning and telling us about your weird hubby. Much appreciated. And definitely, seriously, do look after your stuff, because your wife will throw it out, promise you. When we come back, we are going to talk to a bagiophile live from Germany. What is a bagiophile? Stay tuned to find out.
You know, Ray, I was just thinking about this, and I feel everyone has a weird hobby. They might not actually realize it's a hobby, but they could be collecting something or keeping aside for many years, and then it sort of turns out to be a hobby. I'll give you a quick example.
Go on.
I'm actually weird in a sense, and I didn't realize this till, I guess, today. I collect boxes.
What, like storage boxes?
No, or just any kind of box.
Like, and pretty boxes with tissue paper, that sort of thing?
Not Barbie doll boxes, if that's what you're referring to. Okay. No, any kind of like, any gadgets that I buy, like it could be a microwave oven box, it could be, you know. I keep them.
Why?
I didn't realize this till today, because my entire room is filled with boxes.
You crazy? You're a pack rat.
I think so.
You seriously are a pack rat.
I guess so.
You have to. Do you have to? How bad is it?
Actually, it's pretty bad. I mean, I think if you spoke to my mom, I think she would tell you how crazy I am because I've been collecting this.
I chat to her regularly, obviously, but she's never mentioned how crazy you are. You know,
no, if like I don't, you've never been to my room, but like above my wardrobe. That entire place is filled with boxes.
You know you got a problem when you have trouble opening the door. That's when you definitely have got the problem.
Yeah.
So when you get to that stage, before you get to that stage, please get help. Yeah. we just spoke to a psychiatrist before that. You know, he's a nice guy. Just give him a call. All right.
All right.
Right. We're chatting to people who have got what we would consider to be pretty weird hobbies. Although maybe just hearing that from Faraz, you wouldn't, Faraz, because you're quite crazy yourself. Paul Mundy joins us on the line now, all the way from Germany. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Ray.
How are you doing today?
I'm okay. How are you?
Very, very well. Thanks for joining us on the program this morning. We introduced you earlier before the break. We said we're going to chat to a bagiophile and, you know, sort of confused faces all round. What is a bagiophile?
Well, you've got the term wrong. It's a baggist.
Okay.
It's somebody who collects bath bags or air sickness bags.
Air sickness bags. So these are the things that get tucked into the pocket in front of you in case you feel unwell on the flight.
That's right, yes.
And you collect them?
I collect them, yes. I am not alone. There are probably 150, 200 people around the world that collect bags. And,
okay.
And we swap them with each other.
Okay. And when did this all begin?
Well, for me, it was a long time ago, probably around 1987, where I had a young son. And my wife and my son both got very queasy on planes. Hmm. And so I started collecting bags so I would have something handy to stop them from throwing up over the deck or. And my son used to throw up over in cars as well. So we always had a stack handy. And then we moved house, and my wife decided to chuck out my little collection of bath bags or air sickness bags. And I thought, well, no, they're pretty. I'll start collecting them. And that was around 1996, I suppose.
So I got to ask, since you've collected so many of these bags, have you seen a trend that's changed in air sickness bags?
Yeah. Well, it depends what continent you're on. There are fewer and fewer bags in the air because the planes are more stable now. They fly
higher. I've noticed
that,
yeah. Mm.
So many airlines skimp on costs, and so they put one bag in every three-seat pockets or one a row, or even you have to ask for them sometimes. On the cheaper airlines, you have to ask for them. And sometimes the designs are getting more boring. So it depends what continent you're on. In North America and in Africa, they tend to go for plain white bags, and that's kind of not very interesting for us collectors. We like bags with logos, lots of color, good design, that sort of thing.
Mm. You've got around 2,600 of these now, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
How often do you kind of get them all out and just sort of enjoy your bags?
I don't, because I keep them in file boxes, and getting them out and putting them out on the floor is kind of a pain, because you have to sort them back in together again. You know, it's not like you can... They all have to go back in order, because you want to find them again.
But
so I keep them alphabetically organized by airline.
Okay.
You know, everything from Aardvark Airlines to Zulu Airlines and everything in between. And so you've got to keep them in order.
But if you don't get them out, how can you enjoy them? If you can't, you know,
well,
look at them.
I put them on my website.
Ah, so there's like
pictures
of them.
I can look at the scans on the website. So if somebody wants to know, for example, what is a rare bag, then I can check on the website and I can tell them, well, okay, I think that's Maldives Airlines or an Air Dubai or whatever it is. Mm.
Paul, you mentioned that there's a community out there. There are about 250 of you collecting air sickness bags. So
that's right.
How sort of well-knitted or close is this community? Like, do you guys communicate and sort of talk about, oh, which bag should we collect next? Is there anything that's missing or anything that's exotic?
Well, yes, we have a Yahoo group, and there is a Facebook webpage that you can chat about bags on. But it used to be a bit closer than it was. We used to have a lot more chit-chat. But the bag collecting community has moved onto eBay now. A lot more people are buying and selling bags rather than swapping them.
Really? What's the hottest ticket when it comes to bath bags?
Well, if you want the most expensive bath bag, it was probably $300 or something like that.
Wow.
For a rare bag, they will collect that much. Now, I should add that I don't buy and sell bags. There are people that are mercenary in that respect, but I don't buy and sell. So, which is the only reason that my wife approves of my hobby is because it doesn't actually cost her anything.
Yeah, that's another question we have to really cover. You know, what's the perception of family and friends to this hobby?
Well, to begin with, they were embarrassed. My sister-in-law is a professor at a university, and she said, well, no, don't put your bags on your professional website because people won't hire you, because I am a consultant, and I rely on jobs that people ask me to do. And I ignored her, and I put them on my website. And I actually find that it kind of tweaks interest, and many of my professional contacts actually will collect bags for me.
Wow!
So, Paul, as a collector, what is in the near future? What are some of your aims and goals?
I want to get my collection sorted. I have two big boxes of bags that I haven't sorted yet. In my bedroom, my wife has been complaining for many, many months about these boxes, and I just don't have time. You have to scan them, you have to sort them, you have to think of some witticism to describe them and to put on the website. And well, we moved house a couple of years ago, and I just don't have time anymore. We're doing a lot of work in the garden, and we're working with refugees here in Germany, so that takes a lot of time, and unfortunately the hobby has to take second place.
Paul, it sounds like you've sort of managed to keep control of your passion. Obviously, you know, doing important work there as well. Thank you very much for joining us on the program this morning. Really appreciate finding out about the life of a bagist.
It's a pleasure.
Cheers, Paul.
Send me any bags that you run across.
All right. What's your website? Remind us of your website.
www.bagoffaly.com.
Bagoffaly.com. Okay, there you go. Thanks, mate. That was Paul there. And he, like you said, he corrected me there. It's not baggyophile. He's a baggist. He collects air sickness bags. If you thought that was bizarre, Joy joins us on the line. Good morning, Joy.
Hi there.
How you doing? You all right?
Yeah, fine.
Thanks for getting in touch. You've got an interesting hobby. I think this is one of the more sort of stranger ones, if I can use that word, that's come through to us. Tell us about your hobby.
Well, it's just it's like taking photos of random chairs. You know, I work in Alcoos, and you walk past building sites or whatever, and there's always a. Sometimes it's just a random chair, or that is sort of not the type of chair like a secretary's chair with one arm or something like that, that security guards or workers sit on at lunchtime. And there was one with like four, you know, in a circle. And it just makes me smile, you know. I take a photo of it, you know, like part of a, I don't know, a settee with an arm missing or something like that. And it just makes me smile. So I would take a photo of it, you know, or like a chair totally out of place. You know, you wouldn't expect to see it there. So.
Are you posting these pictures anywhere where people can sort of take
Not
a look?
Not really. No, I haven't got many. I haven't got many because you don't always see it. But if I do see one, it just makes me smile. Photo of it, you know. There's no one sitting in it.
You know, because I can appreciate. I mean, you know, when you go into some of these art shops and you see the big portraits of the doors, all the different sort of traditional appearance doors, and they've made a montage of all of them. I'd love to see.
Yeah?
I think you could do something very similar with this. I think that would actually be quite.
I'm not
popular.
Trying to get like philosophical over here, but I guess a chair might tell you a story, wouldn't it? Like how old it is and. What's it been
through? I know. Yeah, I mean, I did think of doing a like a frame with the pictures in, you know, sort of a Dubai, sort of random chairs. And I agree with doorways as well. I've seen, you know, doorways, they're, you know, the actual doors are very nice. You know, I appreciate that. Yeah. And also, like, numbers, like, my husband used to be a sign maker in the UK. And often if you go, you know, like in Karama or that, you'll go past there. Like a house, and the house number's sort of in paint, you know, like a round paint.
Yes.
And I would photo of it and just say, oh, is it one of his, you know, one of his signs, but things like that. But just... It just makes me smile, you know?
Joy, thank you very much. I'm going to just lose you there just because your line's starting to break up a little bit. But thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your hobby there. Joy just takes pictures of security guards chairs in industrial estates. She sees them there, sofas, chairs, and she thinks they're beautiful. And do you know what?
It's art.
It is art.
It's art.
I can totally see it, can't you?
I mean, absolutely.
And, you know, like, you might hear that and think that's a little bit crazy. But when you, if they were to be compiled, I mean, I'm thinking of, like, you remember Tracy Emin and The Unmade Bed and
all these
sort of, like, artists in the 90s and things like that. And it's like, well, how are normal everyday things art? But like you just said, Fraz, they tell a story, and it's not just the chair, it's like the journey of the chair, the journey of the people that's been using it.
Because most of these chairs are probably not going to be like, you know, they just got them out of a store.
Yeah.
You know, they'll be worn out.
Yeah.
You know, they'll be broken. They probably might be just like, you have to throw them now.
Yeah.
But people are still using
them. Being used. Yeah. If you've got a unusual hobby, an unusual passion, just something that you're collecting, whether it's photographs or stamps,
electronic boxes,
like our baggist Paul, the sick bags off of airplanes, unbelievably. Get in touch with the show. We're your avenue today to tell people about it. We heard earlier from Paul, who's collected something like 2,600 air sickness bags, and then he doesn't ever take them out. I said, how often do you take them out to look at them and enjoy them? And he doesn't do that, but that's because he scanned them into his website. So what he does instead is look at his website. But that's, I find that weird, because that's not the original bag. That's a picture of an air sickness bag.
But I don't think you need to necessarily sort of feel them and see them every day to appreciate them, right? I mean, I think even in the back of your mind, you know, like, you're collecting this and you have it.
Yeah.
I think that's what sort of satisfies you. You like, for me, for example, like I told you about my box collection weirdness hobby.
Yeah, you fessed up.
As long as I know that they're near me, I don't have to look at them every day.
I think you keep them because you are one of those safety conscious people who wants to have the warranty in the box ready in case. And it's just, and my wife does this, and she doesn't doesn't want to throw them, and she doesn't want to throw them away. But that is where I think you might have signs of a problem. Not you necessarily personally, but people, if you get to that
point.
What
a warranty disorder.
A warranty hobby. You're not collecting the boxes, you're collecting the warranties. No, but when you get to the point where you don't feel like you can get rid of things because of what might happen, you know, or you can't throw away a particular piece of clothing because you've always been lucky when you wore that clothing or something like that. Mm. That's when I think you have to look at yourself.
There's also warranty which comes under peer pressure as well. I kind of feel like sometimes, let's say if you're in school or whatever, and you kind of like feel like, you know, you're surrounded by a group of friends who are following a certain hobby, and you kind of feel like, oh, maybe I should get into something as well.
Yes, absolutely. Have you ever felt pressure to get into a particular hobby just because everybody was doing it? Let us know. We're joined on the line now by a man who loves roundabouts more than the average bear. Good morning, Kevin. Kevin Beresford.
Good morning, Dubai.
How are you doing? You're right.
I'm doing very well, thank you, yes.
Okay, now, I sort of introduced you as a roundabout connoisseur, as somebody who travels the world to take pictures of roundabouts. You've kind of formalised your hobby, haven't you? Because you're the head of an association.
I'm the president of the UK Roundabout Appreciation Society, also known as Lord of the Rings. That's my official title.
And so what's involved in being the president, and how many people have you got in your club?
We have a close-knit group of people of 30, but I get emails from all around the world of roundabout enthusiasts who send me pictures of their favourite one-way gyratory. It's more exciting than it sounds.
Yeah, that's one of the first things I think that people would say. It's not a very exciting hobby. What's interesting about roundabouts? Please tell us.
There's nothing more expressive than the roundabout. You can put anything on a roundabout, and I've seen fountains, statues, trains, boats, planes, pubs, churches, you name it, anything can go on a one-way gyratory, and that's what makes them so special. To us, they're like an oasis on a sea of tarmac. They lift our sagging spirits on long, tiresome journeys.
Now, since you have a society, do you guys, like, communicate together and figure out, like, where's this, like, unexplored roundabout around the world, or you pretty much have explored every roundabout?
No, I mean, when you think about it, we all go on holiday around the world these days, so all our members bring back, one guy went to Cuba last year, and he brought back all these fascinating roundabouts. And when people go to Dubai, come on, Dubai's got these amazing gyrati galacticos, we like to call them. They're huge, with huge monuments on them. And they're spectacular, the Dubai roundabouts.
Mm. There's a lot of scepticism with things like this, isn't there, Kevin? I mean, you must have faced some prejudice over your passion for roundabouts.
Well, ridicule as well. But what you have to remember about a roundabout, let's take away the aesthetic qualities. When a roundabout is installed over a set of traffic lights, there's something like 90% reduction in fatalities because they're so safe and efficient and green. If you think about it, all the traffic on a roundabout is going in one direction. Mm. Where the problem lies is in intersections or traffic light junctions, where they're head-on collisions, they're all going in the opposite direction. So it's not rocket science here, and there's a tremendous amount of research being done in America. I think it's something like 40% reduction in fuel emissions when roundabouts are installed. I mean, that a perfect piece of round architecture that goes on around. It gives any local council or city, brimming with a little civic pride, the perfect opportunity to plunk a garden in the middle of a road junction. Now, how perfect is that?
Kevin, so since you have a society, you're a president of that society. Now, there are a lot of people out there who have weird hobbies. So if they want to make a society, how do they go about it?
Oh, that's so easy. In this day of social networking, you just create a blog or whatever. I was actually in a Dolmen of Britain calendar last year. I was Mr. January. But there was a guy in there, I think he was April. He's got 20,000 milk bottles in his house.
Wow.
And he gets his wife to clean them every spring. Can you believe that?
you mentioned the Dolmen's calendar. You have,
correct,
I mean, and you mentioned I mentioned the ridicule. You have appeared in numerous sort of British tabloid publications where they have, said, "Is this the dullest man in Britain?" But yet you speak with such passion about your hobby. You're also very fond of car parks as well, aren't you?
I am the president of the Car Park Appreciation Society, but I have to tell you, I'm the only member of it, I'm afraid.
So how come you're only the president? Don't you give yourself a better title?
Hey, I'm the king of my own world.
I believe you've got good car parks in Dubai as well.
We actually do
an international car park calendar, I think.
Yeah, we genuinely have. That's one of the things you do. You make calendars, but you've also published books as well, haven't you? And people buy them as sort of what, novelty gifts and things for people's birthdays.
I suppose so. Yeah, I suppose they give to friends who hate going to car parks or whatever, who have difficulty navigating roundabouts, but they do very well, my books and calendars. And you've got a sneak preview here, because we're about to announce the International Roundabouts of the Year Award tomorrow.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
And you're the first in the world to know who's won this, so I don't really know whether I should be doing this. But it's the town of Carmel in America. That they have built their 100th roundabout, which is a big thing in America because they don't like the roundabouts in America.
Well, but there are very few roundabouts.
It's a beautiful roundabout. Yeah. It's landscaped gardens. These landscape gardens, you have to see them to believe, and they've got this beautiful fountain in the middle, and it looks just perfect, this roundabout. So there you have a scoop there, yeah? Carmel in America, which will be announced tomorrow.
Well, you certainly know how to make make a roundabout look good.
You heard it here first. Town of Carmel, best roundabout town in the world. Kevin, thank you very much for joining us on the program. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
And enjoy your roundabouts. Any sort of exciting roundabout action coming up?
Well, we'll be announcing, and I can't tell you this, the UK roundabout of the that's in the end of September, and that's strictly under wraps, that one is.
Okay, all right, well, maybe we'll get back in touch when we can talk about that one. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Cheers, Kevin. Kevin Beresford there, the president of the UK Roundabout Appreciation Society and the UK Car Park Appreciation
Society. The only member
of the car... Why do people love car parks, but they don't love roundabouts? This is what I don't understand. It seems like there's plenty to enjoy about all of them. Faraz, you promised at the start of the show that you'd tell us about a hobby that you used to have when you were a young man, and you got a folder there, and it looks a bit ominous. What was it?
So... here's the thing. You might judge me after this, right? But
I already judge you.
I ended up like doing this collection since I was like maybe 4 or 5 years old.
Okay.
And what I do is I used to collect pictures of wrestlers, and they're not just pictures; they're stickers.
Okay.
Stickers and posters of WWE wrestlers.
Hand them over.
Here you go. Okay. Take a look.
I wish we had webcam because you'd be able to have an insight into the mind of a junior Faraz.
Here you have like Shawn Michaels. I mean, like this is like when he was super young.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think people would even remember he looked like this.
No, he's kind of got a white, sort of a white leather tiger print thing.
This
going
is
on.
Crush.
I don't even remember Crush.
I don't even know if he's alive, but if someone out there knows, then, you know.
Wrestling fans, we need to know.
WWE, which is
you
called
were like Crush's
WWF.
Biggest fan. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Bret the Hitman Hart.
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember that?
I remember Bret the Hitman Hart. I don't remember Crush. you were like a dedicated fan.
Take a look at the stickers that I've just handed you over there.
I've got like somebody here, SummerSlam, somebody called Fat Chance. Is that real?
Yeah.
That was his name, Fat Chance?
I mean, some of these wrestlers, British Bulldog, remember this one?
I remember the British Bulldog. In the UK, we had somebody called Giant Haystacks. Have you heard of Giant Haystacks?
No.
Well, some of these stickers you didn't even...
I used to buy them.
Yeah.
And then just keep them. But I didn't like put them on like on books or, you know, fridge doors or whatever. So it's...
What was the fascination though?
Okay, here's the thing. I think it was part peer pressure, and that's where it was kind of going to the beginning of the show.
People made you like rubbish wrestling from the 80s.
I had friends used to collect,
okay,
you know, WWF pictures because it was called WWF back in the days, right? Yeah. And so I kind of felt like I needed to get into it.
Okay.
So I started doing it. So that was part peer pressure and part passion as well at the same time. Then on top of that, I used to collect. Are you ready for this?
Go on. No, I don't think I am ready for it. Go on. Yeah.
Movie names.
You collected movie names.
Yeah. So I think. Growing up, because, I mean, you know, I'm South Asian by descent, right?
Yeah.
Ethnicity. And so a true South Asian parent never let their child watch movies back in the days.
Okay.
No movies, no video games. It was all about studying and getting the good old-fashioned A grade in your studies.
Yeah.
So my movie times and TV time and playing video games was all cut like half. Let's change that to a fraction.
Okay.
So I thought... why don't I sort of come up with a book where I list down all the movies that I haven't seen, that my friends have seen, and I would, you know, cut pictures and posters of it and stick it in that book. So when I would grow up, I could go back to that book, get those VHS, DVDs, and watch those movies.
I don't know how to react to that. I part of me just died. Like, part of my heart there just died for you. Just, I feel so sorry. I'm going to turn your mic off. I don't really know how to deal with this. He's having a breakdown in the studio right in front of us, just remembering his movie madness days when he was a child. And he was so lonely. And he didn't have access to movies. What am I supposed to do with that information live on air? I'm going to go to a break. I used to collect WWF wrestler stickers too. My brother and I used to, along with all of our classmates, I remember all those names, including Crush, who passed away in 2007. I'm not turning Fraz's mic back on for the moment because he's sort of just curled up in a ball at the moment, just remembering those times when he couldn't watch films, so he used to write the names of films into a book and then put pictures next to them. And this news about the death of one of his boyhood heroes, Crush, has it's just been a step too far.
Dubai Today, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Chuck Lamb joins us on the line now. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning. How are you, Ray?
Doing really, really well. And we're speaking to you all the way in Columbus, Ohio. How's Columbus today?
It's warm this summer. It's very warm. We're in Fahrenheit, of course, but it's up in the 90s every day. So it's hot and muggy over here. How really? Is it over there?
Very hot. And I know you're keen to come and visit Dubai one day. It's everything you've imagined and more. I don't know if we're ready for you, though, Chuck, because you've got a bit of an unusual hobby, haven't you? Tell us all about it.
I sure do. I'm known around the world as being the person to call if you need a good dead body in your movie or TV show. So if anybody in Dubai is making a movie or TV show and they need a good dead body, I'm the guy to call. I'm known around the world as the dead body guy.
And how did this all start?
Well, believe it or not, it started as a joke between my wife and myself. We're big fans of the TV show Law and Order. I don't know if they show it over there or not.
Yes.
But we're big fans of the show, and I told my wife, I said, you know, just one time in my life, I'd like to be on TV and see my name in the credits, you know, which a lot of people, I think, would.
Yeah.
And she said, well, how are you going to do that? We don't live, you know, anywhere near where they make TV shows or movies. And that night, I had a dream that I was on Law & Order, and I was the guy laying in the street. So I told my wife, I said, you know, I can be like Superman, except I could be dead body guy. And she started laughing, and a couple days later, we built a website called deadbodyguy.com. She took some pictures of me laying around the house in different funny dead poses, and it within 6 weeks, Ray, it exploded. 6 weeks later, I'm on the front page of the New York Times, and since then, it's been in over 400 publications and two dozen TV shows and movies, and it is just exploded. It's been wonderful. And now I'm known around the world as the guy to call if you need a good dead body.
Yeah, you've literally become famous for playing dead. But you've got, we'll talk about exactly, you know, some of the scenes that you've created in just a moment. But you must recognize that this is a little bit weird, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people will be listening to this now in absolute disbelief.
Well, yeah, but it's weird, but it's weird on the funny side. I see it more as having a dream and thinking outside the box, not to me mention the coffin box, but thinking outside the box of trying to achieve a goal. But if you look at my face, you can see that I kind of look dead, so I'm using what was given to me, you know, to my advantage. I've got bags under my eyes, I'm pale, I make a pretty good dead body, I have to tell you, not to brag on myself, but I make a pretty good corpse.
Your wife wanted to help you to get into the movies, but she could probably neither of you could have imagined how big this would become and how much your reputation would grow far and wide. Does she regret it now?
No, believe it or not, she is wonderful. She comes up with, it's kind of scary, but she comes up with all of the ideas of how to kill me, which scares me just a little bit, just kidding. But she comes up with the blood. She's my photographer. And it's been a family thing. When I get a chance, like on TV or talk shows, I try to take her with me because she's as much part of the team as I am. So, no, we're a team. And even I have six children, and they love it, too. They're all trying to get in on it, and it's a whole family affair.
Well, you mentioned a family affair. Bear in mind, this is a, you know, family show. It's a daytime show. But can you tell us some of the scenarios that you've faked?
Oh, sure. On one TV show, I was strangled. I was a disc jockey and I was strangled. On another one, I was drowned off a boat and I washed up onto the shore. Another one, I had a heart attack. I'd been on the autopsy table. I'm trying. Oh, one, I had my entire face tore off in the movie Thanksgiving, and the murderer was actually a turkey, and he put my face on his face, and nobody recognized that it was a turkey. They kept thinking it was me.
This is beyond bizarre, Chuck. It really is. Do you have trouble thinking of new ways to die?
Well, the trouble is, Ray, is to try to keep it funny and light. Where a lot of people want me to do darker things, and I've had probably 100 requests to do Elvis, believe it or not. And there's certain things where you don't want to cross that line. You want to keep it light, humorous, and funny. You don't want to go into the more demented side or the darker places with it. You know, this is going to happen to all of us. The best way to look at it is accept it, you know, have some fun with it, joke around with it, but you don't want to go to the place where you're going to have bad karma or bad vibrations. And it's been wonderful. Our website, deadbodyguy.com, has had over 50 million hits from 155 different countries. So we're doing something right. And I think as long as we keep it light and funny, we'll be okay.
Well, we're talking to you now. You've been on TV shows around the world. Like you said, you get hits from all over the world as well. How big has the media attention been? Just rattle off a few of the shows that you've appeared on.
Well, CSI Miami. I've been on the Today Show 3 times. I've been on the Tonight Show. What I Like About You on FX. And now we've got coming up Z Nation on the Sci-Fi Network. We just did an episode with them where I'm dead, but I'm undead. I'm a zombie, and I'm very excited about that. I finally don't just have to lay there. I get to walk and growl, too.
Literally a big step up. What would you say to people who think that this is too far? It's too weird.
You know, I haven't had but 2 or 3 people out of 50 million say something like that. I tell them to enjoy life more. They're obviously taking it too serious because, you know what? Nobody gets away with it. We all end up at the same place. You know what I mean?
Hmm. And you're about to get eaten by a shark, I believe, as well.
Yes. I don't know if you know. Do you have the Sharknado movies over there?
Of course
yet?
We have Sharknado. Of course. Everybody
well,
knows
Sharknado. Well, I don't know Dubai. I'd love to see Dubai. So if somebody's going to do a movie over there, I've got my passport. You can get a hold of me at any time.
We've got everything
Sharknado
you've got. It's just hotter.
Oh, gotcha. Well, Sharknado 5, I talked to the producer just a couple of weeks ago, and in Sharknado 5, you will actually see a shark kill the dead body guy.
Wow. It's going to be a big point in your career. Where do you want to get one day? Have you got, like, an ultimate goal that you'd like to reach?
I think I'm there. I think I've done what I really wanted to do. Believe it or not, this started, Ray, I just wanted to do it once, and it just kept steamrolling and snowballing, and we were having so much fun with it that we have exceeded every expectation we could ever have. It's been so wonderful. I've got to meet so many people. I've got to meet some of my heroes from Hollywood, like Mickey Rooney and Debbie Reynolds and all these people that I never thought I'd even get close to, you know, in my lifetime. So, no, I got to tell you, I'm like a 6-foot, 230-pound Cinderella, except I'm bald and dead.
Chuck, I love your story. Chuck Lamb, the dead body guy. We look forward to seeing you being eaten by a shark one day and hopefully coming here to watch it happen in Dubai in one of our cinemas as well. Thanks very much for joining me on the phone.
Thank you so much, and thank you for everybody for all the support. Make sure you check out my website, deadbodyguy.com.
No names on this one says, I like to collect seeds of rare trees. That's actually a really worthy hobby, and actually that's done around the world, isn't it? They have these seed banks nowadays, don't they, Faraz?
Yeah, it's actually become like one of those end of the world type banks where they're preparing for if there's a drought or a famine of any kind, then you can use those seeds and plant them and regrow stuff.
Also, I guess because of the whole sort of genetically modified thing, you know, like to have the sort of the original pure version of the seed rather than the sort of the bioengineered version. We're chatting earlier to a baggist, somebody who collects airport sick bags, and Fraz says, as long as you're not collecting used bags, everything should be fine, which is a very good point. Joining us on the line now, all the way from the USA, is Mike Carmichael. Good morning, Mike.
Morning, how are you?
I say good morning. It's afternoon here, morning, but it's morning for you. It's about 5:30 a.m., isn't it, over there?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it is.
We much appreciate you getting up early, taking our phone call. Mike, tell us what your hobby has been. Well, since the 70s.
Since 1977, I had just a regular old baseball and started painting it. I ran a rod through it so it would I could hang it up, and it would stay suspended off the floor or anything like that. Mm. And I just continued on painting it for 39 years now.
And did it just was it just like a random thought, like I want to paint a baseball, or were you just playing with baseball and like, let me paint this?
It was kind of a thing that I had done years earlier. I had a baseball that accidentally got into some paint, and I wrapped a wire around it, and I just started dipping it in there and painting it sometimes. And my goal was to put 1,000 layers on it. Well, I reached that goal, and I just left it as that. And several years later, I decided to start another one, and that's what I done.
Now, it sounds like quite a big investment. I mean, how many paint buckets have you gone through?
Yeah.
Well, we estimated right now, as of today, over between 600 and 700 gallons of paint.
Wow.
It's grown. It's the baseball's grown in size, but also, you know, the awareness of people has grown as well. People come from far and wide to actually come and put a layer of paint on the ball. How big is it? How much does it weigh? What are we looking at these days?
It weighs over 5,000 pounds.
Wow.
And we just recently weighed it, and It gains weight a lot. You know, a gallon of paint weighs a lot, and the time you put a gallon on there, that's what it does. It's real thin layer when you paint it on there, so it takes a long time to get real big, but it don't take very long to get heavy.
Mm. And who's come the furthest to come and put a layer of paint on the ball of paint?
I don't know how far everybody's come, but we've had about 50 some different countries have stopped by.
Now, I know this must have started off
from all over the world.
No, I know this must have started with a random thought about, like, hey, let's just paint this baseball. But now, after so many years, is this like a planned thing? Like, you wake up every morning like, all right, so today we're going to put on a black paint. Tomorrow we're going to put on a red paint.
In the early years, we painted it quite a few times every day. But nowadays, I let other people paint it for me. If I don't get a visitor today, then I will paint it. But usually we get visitors all the time, and I let them paint it.
Well, that's so cool. I mean, right, it's like people are planning to come down and with a paint bucket and a brush with an aim to paint that baseball.
That's literally what they're doing. You must have met some really interesting characters over the years, Mike.
No, I did. I've met some very interesting people and very nice people all over the world.
Mm.
It's been amazing, the people that you meet. I mean, it's you think I'm strange. Some of them are strange.
Well, that takes me on to my next question. You know, generally, you've obviously had a positive response to this, but do people generally think that it's a bit of a weird thing to do? What about people in your community? Do they support what you do, or do they think it's a bit
very, odd? Very, very supportive around here. Very, very supportive. And a lot of people. A lot of people have brought their own paints, and I have, I've had donations for paints. Mm. So it's not really a costly thing. In the earlier years, it probably was, but I didn't pay too much attention to that because that was one of the things I was going to do, you know.
Yeah, I mean it's already huge. It weighs tons, like you said. One day you're probably going to need a crane to lift that thing, and you're going to need a ladder to get up to the top of it to paint it. I mean, do you just see this going on and on and on, and you know, the next generation taking over?
I hope so. It's getting huge all the time. It's just it takes several years to actually get. In size, but not in weight, you know.
Mm. Well, Mike, thank you very much for joining us at such an early hour. Hope you have a fantastic day, and make sure you don't forget to paint that ball, because you've got to add that layer of paint. Thank you, Mike.
We'd love anybody from your country to stop by and put a layer on there anytime they want to.
Absolutely, we'd love to do that.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. That's Mike Carmichael there, all the way from the US of A, and he's been painting a baseball with a different layer of paint, different colour every single day since 1977, and that puppy has grown and grown and grown. It's almost hard to believe.
I actually wonder if we've inspired anyone today to do any of these weird hobbies. I mean, painting a baseball, what if someone picks up a soccer ball and starts painting that?
No, absolutely. I mean, but there are these things out there, and they kind of just start because people are a bit bored, you've got a crazy idea, then you get into the habit of doing it, and then it picks up attention.
And that's actually a good thing you brought up, right? Because summer is kind of like that time of the year where you want to pick up those weird things because you have a little bit more free time than you usually do, and during this time, you would do all these random things.
Yes. But what's interested me as well is that with all the people that we've sort of spoken to today, their families, their partners, and often their communities are supporting
100%.
Them because it's not a negative thing.
No.
It's a little bit off the wall, but it's bringing, you know, it's bringing some attention. It's you know, it can be helpful for communities in that sense.
And sometimes also soothing for oneself as well, because it sort of distracts your mind, takes you away from your daily routine.
Yeah.
And lets you do something that you truly enjoy, or something that your mind just switches off.
Yeah.
And you are like on autopilot mode. Which is actually very healthy.
Absolutely. Text your weird hobby to 4001 or give us a call, 04-423-1010. Rich texted us in. He said, I actually considered myself to be odd, as I didn't have hobbies that I spend lots of time on. And that is perhaps unusual, do you think, for us these days, people not to have pastimes? I kind of thought it was the other way around. We're all so busy.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody's on social media. And I guess some people would count that as their hobby.
Yeah.
The
Instagram could be a part of hobby as well, where you're taking pictures and uploading. And some people just use their account just to take pictures of random things. Like we just talked about with the lady who was taking pictures of security chairs.
Yeah. I'm going to rattle through a few hobbies here.
That I
think are fairly unusual.
Oh, yeah. Go for it.
You can give me your view. Like, would you ever be interested in doing any of these?
Okay.
Here's something I just don't understand. Parkour. Okay, we all know what parkour is, don't we?
Right.
It's like free running, using the environment around you.
Right.
I
think it's great for fitness.
Well, unless you've went, you know, but all the injuries that people have when they do these things.
Well, you know, there's a proper school for that. You have to go and be trained by professionals.
Professional parkour there's such a thing as professionals?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
There's a school for it.
Well, I don't understand it. I mean, when I see those videos of people doing things like parkour, it looks to me like they're taking the long way around. You know, if you've got the pavement, you can just walk on the pavement. They're jumping all over the place, risking injuring themselves. Okay, lockpicking. Lockpicking is a serious hobby for a lot of people. All over YouTube, you can find videos where people are teaching themselves a lockpick.
You know, while watching movies, I always, the limited time that it I always wanted to pick one because they made it look so easy.
Yes.
Nothing to do with any crime or anything like that. But just, you know, I just wanted to take a toothpick or a safety pin and just sort of pick one lock.
It's cool, isn't it?
Yes,
it's
it is cool.
It does look cool.
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a look at some of these other things that people like to do.
Oh, yeah.
Putting ships into bottles. That's like an old school, old time hobby, isn't it? Does anybody actually do that anymore?
I did it once
when I was
at Jumeirah Beach.
Okay.
I threw like a message in a bottle.
Yeah.
And I tossed it in the sea hoping that someone would ever find it, but no one ever did. So
that is
assuming a fish just
Well, message in a bottle is one thing, but you know where people actually make model ships and then they put them into the bottles and they do. That is something. Here's something that I read about yesterday, which is really interesting. Geocaching is my pronunciation.
What's that about?
Okay, what that is if you've always wanted to go on a treasure hunt, the hobby of geocaching may be for you. People around the world are hiding objects or containers in all sorts of places and then posting the coordinates for the location online. People then go out with their GPS devices seeking these well-hidden treasures. And people love it because it's a great way to get out of the house, explore parts of the town, an area that you've never been to. Mm. And there's a website called geocaching.com, and this is an actual thing. People are it's that, but where I, you know, like you were always, you like the idea of the message in the bottle.
Right.
I used to, when I was a kid,
draw
like fake treasure maps and bury stuff, and then I'd go and follow my own map and then find the thing. You're like, what is it about exploration that kids enjoy so much?
You were your own pirate.
I was my own pirate. Geocaching, I guess that's the adult version of making your own sort of pirate treasure map. Why is it good to have a hobby then? Because, you know, we've got so many people that have been getting in touch with us and telling us about their hobby. Some of the reasons why it could be good to have a hobby as a remedy for tiredness for us. Because if you can go to that, I'm going to use the term go to the happy place, which is wrong, but if you can go to somewhere where you feel calm, in control, you know, if you're collecting things, you've kind of got your collection there and it's all in order and it's quite relaxing and calming. I could totally understand why that would be a sort of a refuge from a very busy, perhaps confusing sort of life.
It's stress-free.
Mm.
It's stress-free and it kind of breaks that your monotonous routine that everyone has these days.
Yeah.
So, and like I said, it kind of, in a weird way, puts you in autopilot where you don't have to think too much and just let your brain relax.
Yeah. Well, one of the things here that's been said is that it's actually having a hobby is a chance to connect with yourself. It's been called one of the best active ways to get in touch with yourself and to explore yourself and who you are through your hobby. And it doesn't actually matter what your hobby is. It's actually having that private time with yourself. And quite interestingly, when you do have a hobby, you're going to strive to create time for yourself and manage your schedule well, because you know you've got that aspect of your life that you are particularly interested in. You maybe are sort of slightly addicted to it in the sense that you want to make sure you keep maintaining it, and so you create time for yourself, for your passion, and that is something that we don't always do enough when we have the dual commitments of work, family life, and all the other things that we need to do as well.
Absolutely. And one thing that I always feel is, like, for example, like celebrities, Ray, right? They always sort of inspire people and start new trends.
Yeah.
And that's why I feel we need to also talk about celebrity hobbies.
Okay. Because there's some bizarre celebrity hobbies out there, isn't there?
Absolutely. Now, I'll take you through some of them.
Yeah.
And you can tell me what you think. But once again, I just want to throw a disclaimer out that I'm getting this information from our good friend Google.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I've spoken to any of these celebrities in person
and
clarified it with them. So our Google friend says that LeBron James, get ready for this, is a big headband collector. So wherever he goes, whichever city he goes, he collects headbands.
I can understand why he'd like them, because he's a basketball player, right?
Absolutely.
And so he wears them. There's a practical use.
Right. And this is, that's a good point you bring out over here, Ray, because the minute I go through all this list right now, you'll notice how passion is driving their career.
Yeah.
Their hobbies are driving their career.
Okay.
Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Right? Guess what he loves collecting?
Old film?
Well, that would have been good, but
old
aliens.
Cameras. Oh, aliens.
Aliens. So any kind of alien toy, any kind of alien sort of a miniature, anything,
oh,
he'll
really?
Collect it. Yeah. Justin Timberlake collects video games.
Okay, but he's essentially still a child. I can understand. I can actually understand why he would still.
Johnny Depp.
Oh, no, I actually know this one. This one's quite famous, but I'll let you reveal
All right. He collects dolls.
Barbie dolls.
Barbie dolls.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what the reason behind that is,
yeah,
but he does it. And he's been collecting for a very long time.
Yeah, I saw a picture of him, and he was I mean, like, when you think that he, if you think that we're talking about a small obsession here,
right.
He is in a room absolutely swamped with Barbie dolls, like swamped, like they're yeah. Only his head is visible in his collection of Barbie dolls.
I wonder how many Kens he's got.
No Kens. All Barbie.
Okay. Yeah. Angela Jolie.
Okay. Yes.
Dagger collection.
And now I totally can see that. I can totally see that.
Why is that?
From Tomb Raider, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see. Maybe she kind of got a dagger when she was on Tomb Raider, and then. Do you not think that's where that might have started?
It could be. Who knows?
All right.
Who knows?
Who else we got?
Who else we got? Will Smith.
Will Smith, yeah.
He loves fencing.
Okay.
And he does it occasionally with his buddy Tom Cruise and David Beckham.
I'm surprised. Really?
Yeah.
David Beckham does fencing?
Yeah, I did not know that. But
I'm surprised that I haven't seen them doing more of that. Like, I'm surprised Will Smith's never been fencing in his movies or anything. You would have thought that he would have incorporated that into it.
That's true, but you never know. It might come up any time, right? I mean, he was here recently in Dubai.
Yeah. Have you got one more for us?
Yes, Simon Cowell.
Okay, Simon Cowell.
Just take a wild guess, Ray.
Telling people they're rubbish.
Spying on his neighbors.
No. Let's just put a caveat in here. This is information you found on the internet. We don't know if this is 100% true.
That's what I said. There was a disclaimer out there.
Yeah. Okay. So that's allegedly his hobby, according to internet.com or whatever it might be.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's some celebrities and their weird hobbies. If you share their hobbies, then, well, you share the lifestyle of a celebrity. Joining us on the line now, we mentioned earlier geocaching, and Rich got in touch with us. Good afternoon, Rich.
Hello, how are you, Ray?
Really well. How are you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
We were talking about geocaching, and I was saying it's kind of weird, but I can understand it because I kind of like to do similar sort of stuff when I was a child, the low-tech version of it. How did you get involved?
Actually, I was competing with my sister, back in 2001, about a year after geocaching launched.
That far back?
And she told me about it. We went out, each bought a GPS, and she lived about, I don't know, about 4 or 5 hours from me, and so we were competing to see who could find the first one closest to them.
Yeah.
And since then, I just, you know, every place I go, I try to find one, at least one, you know, or do something related to geocaching, because it's actually quite a broad hobby. There are events, there are different kinds of caches. It's not just a container sometimes, or there are riddles and mysteries that you have to solve in order to find it. It's really quite, it's very enjoyable. My kids absolutely love it.
Do they?
When we do it. So it's it can be loads of fun, and it can be extremely frustrating when it's a really small container, for example.
Yeah, I'm assuming you'll omit anything that's not safe to say on the radio, but what kind of things do you find when you find these sort of buried treasures?
Well, mostly, it's a small container. A lot of times, especially in the UAE, because it changes so frequently in the UAE, there's small containers only with a piece of paper inside that you sign, basically. So you sign that you've been there, and then you go out to the website and you log that you were there. And if it's a slightly bigger container, usually it's just little trinkets, this little stuff that you might, you know, find in the toy part of a shop. You know, sometimes there's coins from different countries.
Yeah.
In the U.S., there's a lot of tracking of dollar bills using the serial number. So, but it's all quite safe stuff. They have really strict rules about what to put in and what not to put in, and what kinds of containers. I mentioned in my text, I just went to an event in North Wales. There were some 1,500 people there. It was called a mega event, and they have, you know, they had workshops about, you know, how to place a cache and what to put in it and what not to put in it, what kind of containers to use, how to geocache safely. So,
wow.
But it's really exciting. I'd have to say I certainly had my share of you know, near misses with things that weren't terribly safe, but as long as you're aware and paying attention, you can get yourself out of situations quite quickly as well.
Rich, so, after listening to you, I kind of wonder, like, you know, the new game Pokemon, is that kind of similar to geocaching?
Oh, please don't talk about that. Pokemon drives me crazy with that. It's all because we just came back from the UK, and in the UK it's quite easy to get Wi-Fi. So yes, you can go around and find these things, but here we don't have any sort of we have never signed up for a mobile Wi-Fi, so you can't go out, and he's desperate. But it is kind of similar. It's virtual. The thing with those is that to some extent it can be anywhere. So He was in the house, and a Pokemon appeared to him in the house, which is strange. Geocaching, you have to put it in a public place. If it's in a privately owned place, you have to get permission. I mean, I do have a geocache just outside of my house, that I place there. But the Pokemon Go is similar, but it's kind of wherever you can go with Wi-Fi, you can find Pokemon.
Wow, Rich. I mean, I'm amazed. I didn't think it was so well established. It's obviously very popular out here in this part of the world.
Over 800 caches in the UAE. All kinds of caches. There's an event almost every month someplace in Dubai or Abu Dhabi. But as you said when you first described it, it's a great way to see someplace that you probably wouldn't have seen before.
I like the sound of it.
So
I do like the sound of it. It's a weird hobby that I might well get involved with. Do you mind me calling it a bit weird?
No. My wife for a long time called it geo trash. So and I actually had to my brother-in-law. I had to trick him into geocaching once, because he just thinks it's the most ridiculous thing in the world.
Crafty.
But it does still have. I still definitely have doubters in the in the family.
Yeah.
Of people who look at it and think that's really weird.
Rich, thanks for joining us this afternoon, telling us all about geocaching. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you.
Enjoy yourself. Keep listening. That was Rich there, who goes geocaching. They have 80 events every year or so, and there's loads of them. He's got a geocache outside his house. So
you found yourself a new hobby.
I'm interested in it. I like the idea, because recently I just started driving around a bit more, going to Umm Al Quwain and Rack and places like that. And there's so much to see in the UAE if you get yourself on the road.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just drive around, really enjoying it at the moment. That's about all the time we have this afternoon on here on Dubai Today. From myself, Ray, and Faraz, we bid you good day.